Andries Kerpersteen is an economist on a mission to alleviate poverty and the author of The Proprietary State, A Capitalist Vision for Better Governance.
What we need, ideally, is an ethno-state.
I don't agree. There are many ethno-states in the world. Many of those places aren't actually very safe at all. The deciding factor, I think, is the effectiveness of the government. Saudi Arabia is also actually very ethnically diverse, and it's a very safe country.
If you steal in Saudi Arabia, they chop off your hand.
And that creates social trust. That also leads to low crime rates.
You've got to bring about essentially a police state where people are spied upon all the time, where basically it's a reflection of low social trust.
Let's say we'd have a completely ethnically homogenous population. Would that end all conflict? No, because we used to have that, and there was class conflict. Labor unions used to commit terror attacks.
But the general level of social trust will be higher, and is higher, in homogenous society.
Correlation doesn't mean there's causation.
You have a multi-ethnic society which has low social trust, everybody becomes less free.
There are cameras on the street. I don't mind that the government can see where I'm walking. What are they going to do?
You're imposing on yourself, essentially, a kind of a police state. Hello, 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 and welcome to the Jolly Heretic. Now, as you know, chaps, I do not agree with Karl Popper's idea of the open society. I think that an open society is inclined to be filled with rubbish and to become balkanized, but a closed society is likely to stagnate and not be very good either. What we need is some kind of balance between the two. And I think in general, what we need ideally is an ethno-state. It's a state where overwhelmingly it is of one people, one ethnic extended family, because this reduces internal conflict. It militates in favor of ethnocentrism, cooperation, that sort of thing, less crime. And this is a good thing. And I have with me today somebody who doesn't exactly agree. And his name is Andries Kerpersteen. And he is an economist trained at the LSE, originally from the Netherlands. And he is the author of a book called The Proprietary State. So, Andries, hello.
Hello, Ed. Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. Where are you from in the Netherlands?
I'm from Amsterdam. I grew up in the center, on the canals. And since I was 19, I've mostly lived abroad. So I don't really feel that Dutch anymore.
No, well, I was in Amsterdam a year ago, and I can tell you that it's really changed. It's really changed, because I was at university in the Netherlands. Yeah. And in those days, by the canals, it was lined with prostitutes. And now the internet and such like has OnlyFans, whatever, has shut that down. That industry is the traditional Amsterdam prostitute. It's all falling apart. Now, some would say, of course, the openness, the tolerance of the Netherlands, it's a good thing, whatever. I don't know that I agree. But my personal view is that what we need overwhelmingly is an ethno-state, a state which is for it to work well, is an ethno-state. What we need is an ethno-state, because then you get high social trust. Yeah. You haven't got to worry as much about crime. You haven't got to worry as much about disorder or conflict or whatever. Everybody is genetically similar, and they militate in favor of one collective interest. Now, what's wrong with that?
Yeah, I don't agree. I think the social trust and safety has more to do with governance, just effective policing. And there are many ethno-states in the world, many places with mostly homogenous populations, and some of them have small religious minorities or ethnic minorities, and some of them not at all. But many of those places aren't actually very safe at all. Many of those places don't have very high trust at all. And then there's also the factor that in these countries, people of different ethnic groups, they live quite far apart, often, and they live in their own cities. Like, for example, in Israel, you have more Arab cities that are virtually almost Arab, but they are Jewish cities. And Israel is actually a very safe country, as opposed to, for example, many African countries with more homogenous populations. And the deciding factor, I think, is the effectiveness of the government. And Singapore is a good example. Dubai is a good example. One in five people in Dubai, or one of, I think, are Emirati. the rest are immigrants. It's one of the safest places on earth. Saudi Arabia is also actually very ethnically diverse. It's had millions of immigrants come from Asia, from Southeast Asia over the years, and it's a very safe country. There's one anecdote that I heard some years ago in school. I had a social sciences teacher, and he used to do sales in Saudi Arabia for the company he worked for. And at one point, he lost his wallet. He forgot it somewhere in outside of a restaurant or somewhere outside. And a day later or hours later, he asked someone, should I go to the police? Where should I look for my wallet? Right. But one of the locals told him, just go back to that place and it will be exactly there. So he went back and it was completely
Saudi Arabia. This is Saudi Arabia.
So as
Finland, as we know, that if you steal in Saudi Arabia, they chop off your hand.
Yeah.
So this gives very strong incentives.
You might not be very strong incentives, but it's the incentives that make the biggest difference, not the homogeneity of the population.
I was a year or so ago, I was cycling in Finland and I dropped my wallet. I went back to the place where I had dropped my wallet. It was not there. I then went to the police station and that's where it was. Someone had picked it up and handed it into the police station. And there was cash in it. And none of that cash had been taken. And there is no need in Finland to chop people's hands off. They will simply not steal because it's wrong to steal. And they will not steal because they are one big extended family. And they take the view that I am stealing from a member of my family. And we've got enough enemies, Russia, whatever. We don't need to be stealing from each other. So, and equally, you said...
Well, that's a theory.
Right, but effective police, well, it's known if you look at genetic similarity theory, Phil Rushton or whatever, people are more cooperative with people that are genetically similar to themselves. And that's true with ethnic groups as well. They are more cooperative and pro-social.
But is that an important factor? If effective policing, you could also, maybe we wouldn't have to need...
You don't need effective policing. Abolish the police. If people are very high in social trust and high in cooperation... and because they're genetically similar to each other and it's in their interest to cooperate with each other, then you don't need policing. Get rid of it. I think there's an error there. Why? Why do you need policing?
I get there's also an evolutionary reason for it, why people who look similar trust each other more quickly. People who are more genetically similar thereby. And this might contribute to social trust, but how much of the variance in social trust does this explain? Or does Finland have a very effective police? Or does Finland instill certain mores among its population? The Japanese, for example, are not genetically very different from the Chinese. But in Japan, there's a very strict discipline in their civilization. That's obviously not genetic. It has to do with the way the people have been educated, to do with their norms and values. And the same applies to the British and the Dutch. The British, they're much more polite and they wait in the queue. Well, in the Netherlands, that doesn't happen as quickly. And that could also be a factor. So the fact that people look similar contributes
to social trust. Not looking similar,
or being genetically similar,
they literally are. So the Chinese, you know, it's known within Asia, that the people that I've talked to that are Asians will kind of say it's as if we were to compare it to Europe. They used to talk about the Japanese as the Prussians of the East. If we compare it to Europe, the Japanese are like the Germans, uptight, humorless, whatever. Maybe the Koreans are a bit like the British or something like that. I don't know. And the Chinese are a bit like the Italians. And in their behavior patterns, they are quite genetically different, and they're quite different from each other. What I'm saying is that in a high trust society, where obviously, I assume you're familiar with Putnam's research that social trust is strongly based around genetic similarity, ethnic similarity. There was a study by Tatu Vanhanen.
I'm not familiar with the research.
Oh.
Okay.
Well, anyway,
the point is here. My point many is that
within families,
social trust.
Yeah.
Is the connection stable? So my point is, there are examples like Dubai, like Singapore, where the population is very ethnically diverse. There's no, there's a very big Malay community in Singapore. There are Indians, there are Chinese people, there are immigrants. It's genetically a very diverse place. But policing is very effective. They don't chop people's hands off, but policing is very effective. There are cameras everywhere. And they that creates social trust. That creates also leads to low crime rates. So is
You've got to spend, first of all, so what you've got to do is you've got to bring about essentially a police state where people are spied upon all the time, where basically it's a reflection of low social trust. There is low social trust, and therefore you must force people to behave in a pro-social manner by filming them all the time, by having very, very...
Well, I don't know whether they'd have to go that far. In the Netherlands, there are also cameras almost everywhere.
Well, there
and
should
that
be.
Doesn't mean that they have in your home they would spy on you.
I've lived in the Netherlands. It's a gang of thieves. But there should be. I've been, you know, I was at the crime in the Netherlands is beyond anything I've ever seen. But the,
is that true? Well, I've lived there for a long time. I've never experienced that.
It was unbelievable the amount of stealing. Possibly not by Dutch people.
We'd have to base that on the statistics. There are certainly an overrepresentation of the Moroccans and other ethnic communities in crime rates. Also, there are age differences. So, for example, native Dutch people are on average older, and older people commit crimes less often. These are also factors. But that does not mean that having a homogenous society is necessarily good, because there are trade-offs. And it also does not mean that it's in the homogeneity itself, that the variance can be explained by the homogeneity other than just the population itself.
If you look at
one example. I've been to New York, I've been to Amsterdam, I've been to London. I've lived in London for several years. In the Netherlands, I can just walk through a predominantly black or Arab neighborhood and I'll feel completely safe. Nothing, because crime rates are so low that I have nothing to worry about. I won't be looked at. There's not that ethnic tension. People talk to each other. People help each other out of different ethnic groups, especially the Surinamese, very nice people, in my experience. And this is a situation in the Netherlands. In South London, where I lived for a few years, the situation was very different. You always had to look over your shoulder. And one big factor in this is that, quite simply, policing in the UK is very, very bad. There are people who steal bicycles in broad daylight, whereas if I'd run a red light, I'd get a policeman after me to give me a fine, to give me a ticket. So that's also a factor. The police are not effective. A few weeks ago, I was in Italy with my family. And the engagement ring of my sister-in-law was stolen. She had been engaged to my brother had engaged to her just a few days before. And the police came. The burglars had broken into the house and taken cash, jewelry, etc. And the police, they said two things that I found very interesting. The first thing they said was, there's one thing for sure, and that gypsies, because there are gypsy gangs who are on motorcycles, go through the hills, and they do this to everyone. Has had this happen to him at least one time. But the second thing they told me is that we don't go into the gypsy camps. The police does not go into the gypsy camps. So effectively, the police has no oversight, no control over those communities. Is it the fact that they are gypsies?
Yes.
I don't know, but at least some of the variance has to be explained by policing, and maybe policing can be made so effective by better incentives, more cameras on the road, that the whole variable of ethnicity or age or the overrepresentation of men in crime, that all of those things don't matter.
But what's the, I mean,
and I think that's true, because in Singapore, that is the case.
Fine, but
crime
what's the point
is
of
so
it?
Low in Singapore.
You're imposing on yourself essentially a kind of a police state where you don't
no,
need
No, it's not a police
do...
state. The police would
well,
not
yes,
be in control.
There shouldn't be police.
The
should,
police would just
should,
be better, more effective.
No, I shouldn't be menaced by cameras filming me in public places, by police officers, by people stopping me or whatever. I want to live in a high trust society. Like I was in Sointila near Canada. It's an island off Canada. There's no police there. There's no police because there's no crime because they police themselves.
Okay.
There's no crime. If there is corrupt, they go to the mainland. If you look at the study by Tatu Vanhanen in Ethnic Interests, he shows that there's essentially it was something like 66% of the difference between ethnic conflict in different countries is based around ethnic diversity. Ethnic diversity leads to ethnic conflict. So the solution to avoid ethnic conflict
it's a requirement
is
for ethnic conflict.
You not have ethnic diversity. You don't get rid of the ethnic diversity. You get rid of
yes,
the ethnic
or,
conflict.
Or that, I don't think so. You need a government that keeps the ethnic groups from fighting each other. In the 1960s, Singapore had very heavy race riots, but now they're thriving together. Now they live in harmony. It's the government that puts a stop to this. And if we wouldn't have ethnic conflict, let's say we'd have a completely ethnically homogenous population, then would that end all conflict? No, because we used to have that, and there was class conflict. Labor unions used to commit terror attacks. Communist terror organizations used to plant bombs. People had conflict over other things too. And I think that in a democratic society with a democratic system, if there's an ethnically homogenous population, politicians will still try to rally certain groups in their societies or groups based on income, for example, against each other. They would put them up against each other because that's how you get votes. You present another group of people as a problem and you present some plan of yours as a solution, which is taxing the rich, whatever. So it's the nature of our political system that encourages strife between groups, ethnic groups, class, social classes, etc. And when there are ethnic differences, they will focus on that. If there are no ethnic differences, they'll focus on something else.
I never have any time. I'm extremely disorganized. Things basically overwhelm me. I don't know why this is. It's probably some sort of genetic thing. I'm basically present-oriented, a fast life history strategist. I really should find out more. And in order to do so, I should probably read this book, Blueprint by Robert Plomin. It's a fantastic book, and it looks at the genetics of our psychology, the genetic reasons why we have the kind of personalities we have, why we have the kind of intelligence we have. Maybe that would help me make sense of why I'm like I am. I should read that book. But the problem is, as we've established, I never have any time. So I don't really see how I can read it. Or so I thought, until I discovered Legion.com. What Legion.com does is it takes the most basic and interesting books, including Blueprint by Robert Plomin, and it summarizes them into just 25 minutes, and then it allows you to listen to those books. That's my problem solved. Legion.com. And if you sign up today with the code TJH, then you will get 10% off. Legion.com. All the base knowledge from your phone straight into your brains.
But the general level of social trust will be higher in and is higher in homogenous societies. That's just an undeniable fact. And not only that, but there's two reasons for that. One is that there is conflict between the ethnic groups once you have two ethnic groups. But the other is there is conflict within the ethnic, within, let's say, the whites. Social trust goes down in a multicultural society, presumably because people are fear that their fellow countrymen will collaborate against them with the foreigners, which they do. I mean, that's basically the raison d'etre of the left.
That's true. Let's say that's true. Because I haven't seen the research, I don't exclude I'm not saying it's not true. It's a factor in that homogeneity contributes to social trust. But then there is another factor, which there are trade-offs. If you want to optimize for social trust, you have to compromise on other things. You have to compromise on high-skilled immigration. You have to compromise on, which is very important for certain industries, especially the ones that make the most money and bring the most important innovations. You have to compromise on those things. So For immigration does have economic benefits. And so that is one factor. And if it is possible through effective policing, better surveillance, maybe not too much surveillance, but especially better incentives for the police, because I think that's an important factor. The police just don't work very hard because they don't have the right incentives. They just get paid anyway, regardless of whether how many criminals they catch. Through better incentives for the police and better tech, maybe better surveillance. I don't think that's actually a very big factor. But through better policing, you can bring crime rates down so much and maybe higher penalties. But then you can bring crime rates down so much that ethnicity, that social trust, does not become that big of a problem anymore. Differences in crime rates between men and women, for example.
Why not do both then? I mean, why not have a society like Finland, which is very, very high in social trust and very, very high in shame, and relative to the West of Western Europe, extremely homogenous, so that you can just, you know, not lock your front door or not lock your bike or whatever. It's unthinkable that there would be serious crime other than crime committed by immigrants. Why not have that and have punitive policing? Then you can essentially pretty much abolish crime.
Yeah, but then you have to forego the benefits of certain types of immigration.
There are no benefits of certain types.
The reason why
immigration is reducing social trust. The immigration is therefore elevating crime. The immigration is bringing about balkanization. So I think immigration is a terrible idea in the long run.
I don't know. I think if you look at the United States in the 19th century, what brought the United States to prominence? It was the immigration of millions of Europeans, including many millions of Jews, who came to the United States, contributed to the economy. It led to double-digit economic growth for many decades. That's what made the United States prominent. And yes, certain communities were overrepresented in crime. The Italians were overrepresented in crime compared to the native population, compared to the Jews. But that was simply the benefits outweighed the costs. And the second thing is that
the benefits of immigration. You're giving America as the example, but if you look at like Utah, or look at the places that are actually safe in America, they're not only overwhelmingly white, they're overwhelmingly British. They're ethnically homogenous.
Okay.
Yeah.
That may be true, but policing is also just very bad in the big cities on the coast. So there's a correlation there, but the correlation doesn't mean there's causation. There are also Korean communities and people in general are in the U.S. They live with their own ethnic communities.
I don't see how the policing. One of the things that you notice that is the difference between the police in the UK and the police in America is that traditionally the police in the UK is based around trust. They don't even have guns, or at least until recently they didn't have guns. And in America, policing, I would say precisely because it's a multi-ethnic society and people don't trust each other, policing has always been extremely heavy-handed.
Everyone is a potential gun holder there. They do have guns among the populations. Every fool has a gun there or can buy a gun.
We had guns among the population until the 90s.
But of course, but look, we have guns too in the Netherlands. My family has guns, but we have them on a permit. Because people in my family, they hunt, but people can have guns. But if every single person can buy a gun in the Walmart, and especially the bad apples will buy them, then that changes police protocols. Of course, you can't have a soft-handed approach as a police. If you're the police, if people among the populations have guns.
To give you an example, they have to have signs in America, and they already had them years back, that say things like "no loitering." Now, in Britain, we do not have signs like that. In Finland, we do not have signs like that because people don't loiter.
Yeah.
And there's a certain kind of person of a certain racial background that loiters. And so once those people start coming to the society, you basically have to make the society less free. You have to make it so that it's a problem for anyone, even with quite legitimate reasons, to just stand around. If you have a multi-ethnic society, which is low social trust, everybody becomes less free so that you can police the antisocial foreign element within your own society, because certain ethnic groups are more likely to commit crime and more likely to be antisocial. And these are exactly the kind of people that are important.
Look, that's an argument, but you have to really get specific of what is then the trade-off in practice. What do we have to suffer in order to make in a heterogeneous society with all its benefits, because it does have economic benefits. I don't know in any ethnically homogenous place where I could do this, have the same opportunities as I have in the more diverse places like London, Paris, New York, etc. That's just a trade-off. But let's say that's true. What exactly would we have to suffer for that? That sometimes we get checked by the police for whether we carry knives. That sometimes we'd have they would stop us over to check our car whether we have guns or drugs on us. If crime rates are naturally higher, then we might just have to accept that. But to me, that's not a big problem. It just in practical terms, they check you. There are cameras on the street. I don't mind if the government can see where I'm walking. What are they going to do? It's not my bedroom.
No, but the idea it infringes on an Englishman's liberty, and which we always
liberty,
have.
But so what liberty? The liberty not to be seen by bureaucrats.
Yes, yes.
I don't think that's an important liberty.
It's spying on people.
The police can see you on the street.
It's a surveillance state. And moreover, you go back to if you look at countries even now that have said no to immigration.
Google knows where your phone is, right? Google knows where your phone is. That's how Google.
Well, in my ideal world, that would be a criminal offence. But if you go back to societies now that don't have much immigration, that are basically overwhelmingly white, like Slovenia.
Yeah.
They are not. I can't see how they are suffering economically as a consequence of this. I mean, I can't see what has immigration given Finland.
Oh, no, suffering, other than, but they're foregoing certain benefits.
Extremely lazy people who can't be bothered to cook, to order takeaways to be brought to their houses by Somalis on bicycles. I can see nothing else that it's brought.
Well, and I like
the exchange is women in only
cheap taxis, cheap food deliveries.
Where are these cheap taxis? We don't have cheap taxis here.
They're cheaper.
Having food deliveries.
Cheap taxis is a good example. But can I just make one little remark about cheap taxis? It's a very good example. If you have low-skilled immigration, and I'm not definitely, I don't think we should just let everyone in who's low-skilled. I'm just saying there's a benefit, which is ceteris paribus, you'll have cheaper taxi rides. But a very important factor is local taxi cartels, which are local taxi monopolies. That's what makes taxis so expensive in London. Wages are very high. Food deliveries are very cheap. And the people who wash your car, they barely get paid. But taxis are very expensive. Why is that? Because the government does not do what it's supposed to do. We can't get those benefits if the governance of our society isn't good. If there's corruption, if there are special interests whose interests get precedence over us, that is a big factor. If those conditions wouldn't be there, you'd like Dubai, things are quite cheap there, considering what people make, compared to what people make on average in Dubai. Things are quite cheap. Why? Because the government has no interest in giving anyone a monopoly. That would only increase its cost of living and make its jurisdiction less attractive to the people who move there, and thereby depress their the land values, which they make their money on. So the policy is much more important. And there is one good argument that I see people make, is that immigration changes policy. Immigrants take their culture, their beliefs from their societies. And in some societies, there's much more socialism. There's much more people vote along ethnic lines. That's true. I agree on that. But that's one of the reasons why I've written The Proprietary State. which is that we should have governments that have shareholders instead of voters. And then all these problems, we wouldn't have them. We'd have governance, the governance we prefer. And if you would then prefer to live among people who are of your ethnicity or before, for example, your sex, I can imagine that some women just want to live among other women because that eliminates 98% of crime. Then a government has an interest to create a place exactly, and if there is enough demand from others, to create a place exactly like you want it. Because then you prefer to stay there more, then you're willing to pay more in taxes in order to stay there. If the government itself is a for-profit corporation, this will be provided to the people. Or, for example, Jewish people who prefer to live with the Jews, Muslims who prefer to live with Muslims, etc. Or Africans who prefer to live with Africans because they have maybe they have their insider jokes and they just get along with each other better. Those are all things that make people prefer to be with their own ethnic and religious groups.
I suppose you could call, in many ways, a government a kind of protection racket. And in some ways, yeah, very much like a protection racket, in that it says, you will pay me for protection or you will be punished. So it's very similar to the craze in London in the East End in the 50s, going into pubs and saying, pay
for protection. The stationary bandit.
Right.
Yeah. There's a very good paper written by Mentor Olson, an American economist, called The Stationary Bandit. And there he basically reasons from first principles, praxeologically proves the inevitability of a government, how governments will emerge as protection rackets in the lightest form, and then they will also introduce policies to make sure they can extract more.
Yes. So this is what they are. They are a protection racket. And the idea is that you get something out of it. And if you get something out of it, let's say if we go back to England or even the Netherlands, I don't know as much about the Netherlands, but in England in the 16th century, the government controls London. And that's basically it. Outside of London, there are warlords. Like in Somalia now, there are like Al-Shabaab or whatever. There are warlords. And you pay protection or you fight when asked for that warlord. And in return, if someone tries to get onto your land and steal it or whatever, he helps you out. And equally, it corrupts the whole system. If you're in his clan, then and you go on trial, He will go in there and nobble the, you know, bribe the judge or whatever, and you know, get you out of it. That's the protection. Now, so a government, as far as I can see, is basically a protection racket. So in which don't we all have a kind of a share already in what's going on? And if they're too crap, then that government gets overthrown in a revolution and its leaders get killed,
or it gets voted out. In the way we, in our systems, in the democratic system. But here's the problem. In the government does hold the guns, so it's very difficult, especially in the modern times, to overthrow a government militarily. I don't believe in revolutions anymore. They don't exist. The uprisings we call revolts, like the Syrian civil war, was just a proxy war between different regional powers. There is no such thing as revolutions anymore because we've moved way beyond the age of muskets and bayonets long ago, and now we're in the age of tanks and drones, and we're not going to win that battle. So the way we make sure a government gets overthrown is by voting them out if they don't do what we want. But there are problems in this system, which is that all of us only have one voting right, and millions of others vote, which is that nobody has an interest to really dive deeply into government affairs, into the government finances, and so there is a lot of rational ignorance. The second factor is that everyone gets the right to vote, regardless of how smart they are, regardless of how knowledgeable they are about governance. And this stands in stark contrast to how corporations function, which is that the people who own the most shares tend to be the most accomplished, successful entrepreneurs and investors. So the people who are more, have a better understanding are more successful and have a bigger say in things in that system. But in our system, that's not true. So we don't dive into the facts. We're not knowledgeable enough to judge policies well. And as a result, there's a lot of corruption. There's bureaucracy. there's a lot of ideological policy making. Governments are relatively ineffective and inefficient, and the incentives aren't aligned. Because an elected politician, has an interest to extract as much value as possible from his position, so corruption, and to get reelected so he can do it again. But a monarch, for example, a monarch has an interest, because monarchs get part of the financial gains, to maximize the present value of all profits that he can get from the government, to make people as productive as possible, to make the place as safe as possible, such that people don't leave.
This sounds very, very similar to what Thomas Hobbes argued.
Yeah, Thomas Hobbes and Hans Hermann Hoppe wrote a book years ago, Democracy, the God That Failed. He made similar arguments. But I think there's an even better system, which is proprietary governance. So instead of a monarch, we have shareholders. Because a monarch has a succession problem. What if the next monarch just turns out to be an idiot or a radical or whatever? But in proprietary governance, in a proprietary system, the shares end up in the hands of competent investors. That's how the capitalist system works. So the most competent people will be at the helm, and they will pursue profit. And if you make the right institutions, if there's a separation of powers and a constitution, the shareholders just can't just do what they want, but they're limited in their conduct, then these jurisdictions will compete with each other. Then you will just go to the competitor. And especially nowadays, you can just take a plane and move to another country.
Right, that's interesting. Now you're moving beyond this nonsense about how it's good to have takeaway food, even though we've got the recipes ourselves, and immigration, all this crap. That's quite interesting. So if you look at South Africa, increasingly, there is no government. You can't rely on the police. It's just in the air. It's just Wild West. And the consequence has been the rise of protection rackets. They call themselves private security companies. They are protection rackets.
Yep.
The police are too incompetent and corrupt to do anything about them, even though they could, but they don't. So the result is that the biggest one is run by a guy who used to be a South Africa international rugby player, Afrikaans guy. I forget his name. He has the largest one. And if you advertise on your house that you're in his retinue, basically. And it's very clear that if you break into that house, there's going to be the most complex stuff in there that's going to bugger you up. And so, in a sense, he's almost like the governor for a lot of people in South Africa. And he has competitors, but he's effectively in charge. So that works, seemingly, as long as the government remains.
It works seemingly. There's a problem, which is that there's a sort of a valley of death between such an organization becoming an actual government with an administration, with competent policymakers, and the ability to invest in large infrastructure projects, etc. And between the opposite, which is just a private protection racket. So when it is possible that such an organization would grow into a proper government, but then also it wouldn't have the checks and balances and the institutions necessary to make the system work well. Because whereas the baker and the butcher and the supermarket can't force people to be their customers, a government can, and because they hold the guns. So you need institutions within this organization, like a separation of powers and a constitution and all of that, to make sure the system actually does serve the people well. So even though it's better for people to be under such an organization than the completely incompetent failed state that South Africa has, it's still not ideal. It still carries risks, and it's still not necessarily efficient. Also, because they tend to fight their competitors, and then their success depends on basically military success and not commercial success, and this also becomes a factor. So they shouldn't be able to shouldn't have an incentive to actually fight the competitors militarily.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of shareholding, one thing I do find extraordinary.
Jolly Heretic is a Reader Support publication. Receive new posts and support my work. Consider becoming a free or paid subscriber at jollyheretic.com.
Independence Day was no taxation without representation. And surely the inverse of that must be no representation without taxation, i.e., that the reason why there should be democracy is because the government is saying to certain people, I want, you must give me a portion of your income. And it is reasonable for those people to say, if I must give you a portion of my income, then I want a say in how my income is being spent and by whom.
Of course,
I want a person that's going to competently spend my income. And so therefore it is reasonable.
But what if you can vote? Yeah, but what if you could vote with your feet? What if the government, some say 100 miles away, if there's a competitor that you could, that you're free to go to and the switching costs aren't too high, what if you could go to the competitor and the government can stop you from doing so? Then it doesn't matter as much what the government, any democratic vote wouldn't matter that much because you would vote with your feet anyway. Dubai could keep its millions of residents there captive. They could basically lock the borders and keep people from leaving, like North Korea has done. But they don't, because they treat people like customers. They want to attract more people. So under, at least under their conditions, and Dubai doesn't even have all the institutions that I advocate. But even Dubai is currently under such conditions, or the Emirate of Dubai at least, that that is the best thing for them to do. That's in their best interest. Treating people like customers, maximizing on safety. It's super safe. It's clean. It has everything. It's easy to start a business. Taxes are low.
Yes. So what would be the nearest historical parallel to what you're talking about? What about the East India Company? The East India Company was a company with shareholders that was able to take over a portion of India.
Yeah. So the institutionally, the best historical, the closest historical example are actually the first American colonies in the 17th century. These were run by private corporations. They were created and run by private corporations. And also, not only the English colonialists, but also the Dutch. And these communities were, had proprietary governance. But there's no close historical example because the institutions were different. They didn't have that separation of powers. The West India Company, the Dutch West India Company, they basically were a dictatorship under the governor. And the same applied to the East India Company. The East India Company is also institutionally another example. It's a private corporation. It was a private corporation that was granted rights of government. They had their own armies, they had their own police, judges, etc. But its conditions and objectives were very different. So they used these rights of government to secure a trading monopoly. They didn't get involved in the local governance of the East Indies. That was left to local rulers. But they simply wanted to extract as much wealth as possible, to buy spices for the lowest price possible, and to secure a monopoly on those spices to keep the Portuguese out and other contenders. That those were very different conditions, and these corporations didn't have a separation of power of powers. They didn't have a constitution for the people they governed, or any rights enshrined in any constitution. They didn't have any of the institutions that I think are necessary to make this go well. But there are very good examples of what would happen if you don't make these institutions. If you don't create these institutions, then people will be treated like cattle, not like customers. And so that's those are institutionally the best examples. But when you want to look at the governance that we can expect, I think Dubai is the best example right now. Dubai and maybe to an extent Saudi Arabia and Bahrain, but especially Dubai is a very good example of how a proprietary government would govern today. Actually, the closest example, which is off the radar of most people, is Prospera in on Roatan in Honduras. They are actually the first official sort of semi-proprietary jurisdiction in hundreds of years. So they have a special economic zone that they govern, or at least they have a very large say in that, in the governance of that zone. And so de facto, at least currently, they can make the rules. So they have very low tax rates. You can very easily start a company online. You can get online, you can get e-residency from anywhere in the world and start a company there. There's only a 1% revenue tax, and that's it. And I think a 2.5% VAT And that's basically it. And they have very good policies, very innovative policies, which is why many biotech startups are setting up shop there. Because under the FDA, it's very difficult for these startups to innovate. So that's why they moved to Prospera.
But if you're in Dubai...
Those are good examples.
Tell me about Dubai on an everyday level. I've not been anywhere like that. The nearest I've done is I've done a lot of research for universities in Saudi Arabia. It seems to me these places are not free. There are restrictions on, heavy restrictions on the kind of things you can say and do, and even the kind of people with whom you can mix. Is that fair?
Officially, yeah, but in practice, these restrictions are much smaller than officially. There, for example, a Dutch Gordon. He's a Dutch singer. Probably he's like the Dutch Elton John, a gay guy. He moved to Dubai, and he told on television that officially homosexuality is forbidden in Dubai, but they don't enforce that. Dubai is full of gay people, and they not full of gay, but it has a lot of gay people. It's it's probably the biggest gay scene in the Middle East outside of Tel Aviv. And so de facto, what Dubai is doing, even though officially they have Sharia law, which is in its strategic interests, in practice, they are serving the customer the way the customer wants to be served. And many of these customers are gay or bisexual, so they can do what they want. People can also actually drink in Dubai. So it's much more liberal than it is on paper.
Right, but it only takes a slight change in the attitude. I suppose you could say, then you can leave. I suppose that's the interesting thing, though, because presumably these white people that live in Dubai are not citizens and cannot become citizens.
Yeah.
They are solely there as customers of a state.
Yeah, as residents or tourists.
And can go somewhere else if the state annoys them. And so... Yeah.
But I, as a citizen, as a Dutch citizen, I can also leave the Netherlands.
Yes, but you need to be a citizen of somewhere. So you can leave. I mean, I've left England. My attitude is I have voted with my feet. I voted my feet 20 years ago this week because it was so bad under Tony Blair, you know, lack of free speech, all this nonsense, the beginnings of the hell we have now. I saw it coming, and I'd lived elsewhere. I'd lived in the Netherlands, and even in the Netherlands, it wasn't as bad. As England in terms of restrictions, and so I left. I'm surprised more people haven't done. Well, they are doing so. England is hemorrhaging millionaires at the moment, and it's currently a big problem.
I think it was. I saw a statistic today: 16,500 per year.
Yeah, the government are trying to find all these ways to get more money because via taxing ISAs, via taxing inheritance on farms, which of course we have to sell the farm, via all of these different means, because the clever, not only are we getting stupider, we know that, but the clever people, the innovators, can leave, and they are leaving, and they're going to places like Dubai.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yes.
But you know, the one crucial difference is that if you vote with your feet by leaving the UK, it does not have the same effect as when you vote with your feet leaving Dubai, because Dubai pursues profit and the UK government does not. So the UK government doesn't care too much whether you leave the country, because you're not the kind of person who would vote for the incumbent party anyway. If you're the kind of person who would vote for the opposing parties, then they're actually happy if you leave, even though the tax revenue their tax revenue decreases as a result, because then they can secure their control. They'd rather import, they'd rather take in unskilled and immigrants and people, Sunni Muslims from Pakistan, etc., because these are very loyal voter bases, instead of attracting high-skilled immigrants, high earners from Dubai or the US or other countries. Those are not going to vote for the Labour Party. So what is in voting with your feet is only effective if governments themselves are private corporations or monarchies.
Well, presumably, though, if you get too big an exodus of talent and you make up for it by low-level people, then eventually you get a society that is so chaotic that it invites a massive backlash of the right, of the opposition, and it creates eventually such chaos that you have almost like a low-level civil war and the society collapses into de facto enclaves.
Yeah. But this is something that would happen on the long term. And the incumbent politicians, their incentive, their interest is to look one election cycle ahead or two election cycles. But this is that's a process that could happen over many decades. But by that time, they've already extracted their part of the public wealth. They've already benefited, from having their positions, and then they can jump the ship. And that's why the rulers of South Africa don't restore the country. They loot it even more. They're scraping the bottom of the barrel of the state finances. It's because it's not their long-term position. They only have custody over the state.
Are you ready for the future of the West?